Hi everyone, welcome to this episode of Standing on Points, the History and Culture of Punctuation. This episode will be probably shorter and we'll speak about what can we do to a text without adding any marks that is still punctuation. How can we punctuate a text without any graphic symbols, I suppose. And I'm going to call this episode Nothing Is But What Is Not Punctuation Which Isn't. And I just want to unpick the title a little bit, because the first part, Nothing Is But What Is Not, is from Macbeth, which is my favourite play, I think, because it just is so confusing. And I really don't know what the quotation means. I think it might mean that sometimes we think we know what something is, and then it's something else, and then it seems like this, and it's actually something different, and then we think, oh well, we have grasped the thing that's different, it turns out to be something else again. So it sort of continually slips away when we want to grasp it, or when we have thought we grasped it, which is what I feel like with punctuation. Sometimes I think I know what it is, and sure enough, I will think again and I will question it again, which is sort of similar to what I will explore today, where you think, well, surely punctuation is like a dot or a question mark. And then actually other things also turn out to be punctuation or punctuation-like. And then, you know, everything becomes kind of fuzzy and nothing is but what is not. And this brings me to the second part of the title, Punctuation Which Isn't. Because I'll be talking about, for example, how we can add space, so nothing basically, to a text and thereby punctuating it, which is inserting structure, inserting difference and boundaries. And so most people, everyone really, I think, that I've talked to about this project has said, well, punctuation is like comma or an exclamation mark, including myself. I would also just enumerate graphic symbols, I suppose. But then when I say, well, what about space? People sort of tend to forget or not think about other ways of manipulating a text that also tells us where one word starts or finishes and another one starts. So punctuation, which isn't, I guess, is something like space. It punctuates the text, but it's not a mark, right? So today I will be talking about layout, space, size of letters, for example, and script. But I don't want to get ahead very much, so I want to take things slowly. Right, so the most obvious thing to do with a text, and of course, now that we have computers and Word, it's really not a problem anymore to change a text after we've written it, right? So you copy-paste, and you can meddle and change the structure however you like. You know, you can take something that you wrote 10 years ago, and you just kind of copy-paste, cut it up, and nobody's able to tell when you print it out or when you send it, that you've actually sort of done something to the text and you've changed sections and so on. But when you obviously write on a piece of paper, or when you carve into wood or into clay, or you embroider, or you tattoo, or whatever it is, you know, whenever you write in the real world, that's not possible anymore. You can't change afterwards. We could maybe cut up a page and copy and paste, literally, but you won't be able to meddle with a layout as such afterwards. And this is also why, you know, punctuation until sort of the 6th century, punctuation in terms of graphic marks was added afterwards by the reader mostly. But this was really adding the dots and the dashes, as it were. Of course, just sort of mostly dots and hooks or whatever. But that, again, is a mark that's added afterwards. But you can't add a whole line of space between verse, two stanzas or something, after you've written it, right? If you write it together, you write it together. There's no way of changing that. And I think that's actually kind of quite significant change in terms of thinking about text. And, you know, either you really handle it and you maybe mishandle it and you cut it up, which is not necessarily mishandling, because there are there's an interesting phenomenon where people would cut up Bibles, also some women, I think, in the 17th century, the way that they sort of preferred and liked, and just copy and pasted verses together the way that they liked, you know, which is quite a thing to do to the Word of God, I suppose. But that was totally okay for them anyway. And nowadays, we maybe don't have that sense of finality anymore, because we can just do anything with the text, which is great also, because it helps you write, I think, when you can be less scared of, oh my God, is this the right kind of start? And should I, you know, put a blank here? Because you can always change it afterwards. But I think it does change something fundamental in terms of understanding of, I suppose, what comes out, or of linearity in a way. But I don't want to go into that. I think, again, I find it a bit confusing. So I want to stay with the obvious, I suppose. So, the problem with retrieving or tracing punctuation is, or writing or whatever it is of course that at some point we don't have evidence anymore. So spaces might have entered writing well before the evidence that we have. But the earliest evidence of spaces to mark pauses is from around 50 BC. So that's not a space after a word, as I've talked about before. You know, people would just write without stops, without spaces, just the words one after the other, and also not, you know, necessarily care about a sentence ending. That's called scriptio continua, and I've talked about this in a couple of episodes before. But there would be spaces sometimes within paragraphs to mark off endings of thoughts, I suppose. Maybe sometimes an ending of a sentence, but it was by no means a regular thing or a standard thing. But by 50 BC, there is evidence for leaving a little blank somewhere to mean, well, something has ended here and something new is starting. And they would also, for instance, leave space, so a blank line or some kind of space on the page between two texts of different kinds. So maybe if there was a copy of a speech by Cicero and then the work by Caesar, they would just leave some space to mark that here is something new starting. This kind of practice, I suppose, of, I don't want to say random, but individual choices when to add spaces, even just tiny spaces, still without, you know, punctuation as such, without necessarily putting a full stop in quotation marks or whatever they thought was a full stop or marking a full pause. That was just a little space between some words, some sentences, some sections. But that already speaks of a certain concept of knowing, well, okay, I'm sectioning something off here. Here is a boundary. This belongs to that, and that belongs to that. Which is, I guess, the main realization of the work of punctuation, which is, so the primary work of punctuation, regardless whether it be a space or empty space or a dot, is to create boundaries and to say this belongs together and that doesn't belong together. For instance, those syllables are one word and those are syllables of another word. And that kind of concept must have been around then already, or that understanding. Now, to sort of jump ahead 5 centuries or 6 centuries almost, as Christianity became more prominent, and as you know, you had to sort of make sure that the word of God is being transmitted the way that you think it should be transmitted, or that the way that the church has agreed on, the you know, bishops and pope and church fathers and so on. You have to make sure that it can't be changed afterwards, which is why punctuation is kind of dangerous, even because depending on where you place stress or pause and say, well, this word belongs together and that doesn't, that can really significantly change the sense. I have some examples, but I don't want to talk about them now because I will be recording an episode on holy punctuation soon in terms of Christianity, Judaism and Islam. So I don't want to get ahead, but you can well imagine, you know, you can understand without really having an example, I suppose, that it's really, really important to make sure that after the Bible has been or transcribed, the text has been written, you can't change it anymore. So what one of the church fathers called Jerome is doing, who has translated, who has gathered lots of texts in Greek and Hebrew and translating them into Latin to create the Latin work that is accepted by most of Christendom at the time, Saint Jerome, he would write. And there's, I think, even another text in his hand. I think it is in his hand. Not even a scribe of his. So he must have done it himself or have seen it. And he writes percola et comata. So he uses the layout in order to signal grammar. I've talked about cola and comata before. So these are units of sense in the sentence. So, for example, from one comma to the next, that's one line. And then from one comma to the full stop, that's another line. Or here is a whole line until the colon, and then here is the next line is the rest of the sentence. And so he is trying to just put one unit of sense, of grammatical sense, per line. So afterwards, you can't really change it, right? You can add, you know, whatever you like. You can add decoration or maybe add dots, distinctions, as they were called, and say maybe, you know, mark pauses within those lines, actually. And again, of course, they were within those units of grammar, there would be no space. So the words would just be one flow of words. So there was still quite a lot of room for interpretation and confusion, probably. But you do have this layout clarification. And that's unchangeable. This was one way of trying to fix how stuff was being read. Because unless you meddle with it, and then it becomes obvious that you do, right? You can't really change it afterwards. And so I think, oh yeah, that's another thing I wanted to say. The actual spaces between words happened in the 8th century when monks in Ireland who were copying texts struggled with Latin not being their first language, or not, you know, the level of Latin, the knowledge had perhaps declined in the past centuries. So while they were copying, they struggled with realizing which syllables belong together. And really, if you don't know a language, then how are you supposed to tell what belongs together in terms of endings and, you know, prefixes, suffixes, and so on. So in order to help them understand the words, and also maybe when they were studying or reading out and intoning the words, in order to be able to read it properly, they started to add little spaces between the words. And that's really, that's a stroke of genius in a way. That's sort of just waiting to happen, right? Then there was no going back in a way, because the manuscripts with those spaces between the actual words would go to England, where Anglo-Saxon scribes would sort of take over and imitate that custom. And then Anglo-Saxon England at the time was actually a place of great learning, and so they would bring that back to the continent from, you know, they also took Italian books, for example, and then they would bring it back. And also, one of the greatest scholars of the 9th century, Alcuin, who was educated in York, brought all those practices to the court of Charlemagne on the continent in Germany, I suppose. And he and Charlemagne sort of worked together to revive learning and revalue Latin and sort of classical Latin, and also doing something to how a text looks like in order to make it more readable, more easily readable, and more easily accessible. So, for instance, Alcuin, who sort of became something like maybe Minister of Education or something like that for Charlemagne, the emperor, advising him, you know, to gather manuscripts and copy them, and to reform orthography. For instance, Alcuin wrote a treatise on the need for standardized letter forms, standardized letter shapes, to reduce diversity of letter shapes, to make it more, just to enable reading a text from one end of the empire to another. Because very often people would have developed local ways of shaping, which makes a lot of sense, right? If you're not necessarily, if you're like a monk in a monastery and you're not traveling, then there's no need in a way to have a standardized text if the texts don't really circulate, right? So Alcuin really tried to, working with Charlemagne, tried to boost education, boost levels of Latin, the kind of Latin, boost readability, and also, early standardization, attempts of standardization, because they realized that how something is written is key to access in terms of reading. And maybe that's a good segue to the next part, which is the size of the letters, because Alcuin and Charlemagne also are responsible for the Carolingian Renaissance or revival, depending on how one wants to look at it, I suppose. Because with those letter shapes and reforming letter shapes and choosing something that they thought was more readable and stuff, there was also the invention, I suppose, of or institution of capital and minuscule letters. So I'm sure you have heard Carolingian minuscules. Because before the Romans or Greeks would write, and then early Christians would just write in capital letters, which, you know, makes sense, because if you think of the first writing perhaps coming from carvings of stone, pillars or something like that, you can't really carve easily round shapes, for instance. So it's much easier to carve in a capital A than a, you know, now lowercase a, for instance, because of the material. So scribes or writers would imitate that that capital writing technique. But Alcuin, in his reforms, pushed for greater definition of letters, which also then means, making sure that a sort of more definition in terms of from letter to letter in terms of the relation between the letters. So, capital letters. Oh, I don't want to say call them capital letters because they were not. You can only have a capital, like a truly capital letter, if you have a lowercase letter, right? Like uppercase, lowercase letter. Because otherwise, if there's no way of comparing, you don't have another shape for the letter, then you just have one form. So we don't really want to call it capital letter as such, because I think you can only call a letter that's big capital if you can also... if you also have the smaller form of it, the smaller version. But what people did have was to, or what they did do was just to make the first letter of a line or a word bigger than others. So, and that's called litera notabiliores. So letters that are more notable, that come out more. And this practice was around for quite a while, actually. I think, where is it? I made a note. Yes, 200 BC. So that's really quite early, actually, where people would just enlarge the first letter of a new sentence or a new paragraph or a new section, which doesn't mean that it comes at the beginning of every word or like it is in, for instance, German nowadays for noun or whatever. And it wouldn't mean that it comes at the beginning of a line, as in verse, or be consistent, but within the scriptio continua, remember 200 BC, so that's still, you know, well into Roman times, people would mark off the beginning of something else, a new paragraph, in quotation marks, which is... I don't mean to say that by paragraph that they would leave a space. No, they would just continue the writing. But there's a new section of whatever sort, a new thought, a new grammatical unit. So they would put the first letter bigger. They would make it bigger, more notable. That's why it's called litera notabiliores. And this might also happen with verse, for instance, then that might be combined with indentation. So I forgot to say that when I spoke about the spaces, a certain kind of indentation of verse was actually around quite early as well. So people would manipulate left hand indentation, right hand indentation. You know, they had a sense of the margins as well. And as time went on and scribes were copying biblical texts or Christian texts, those litera notabiliori, so just enlarging the first letter of the all caps writing, as it were, that would then maybe become a historiated letter, so they would, you know, make it especially beautiful, decorated in certain ways with flowers or lines or colors or something like that. So, as in other languages as well, for instance, Persian, punctuation and decoration sort of goes hand in hand as well, which is sometimes makes it a little bit difficult to tell it apart. But the size of the letter, so the just making a letter bigger makes it stand out, you know, means here's something else happening. Again, you can't change it afterwards. That has to happen as the person is writing, as you are writing. And it's not a mark, there's no graphic, whatever. It's just doing something to the words themselves, to the letters themselves. And again, in Ireland, you know, the Irish monks in the 8th century that also invented spaces between words, they would have a beautiful custom of diminuendo. So they would have the first letter really big, first letter of a new section, for instance, really big, and then become a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller, a little bit smaller, and then just keep writing in capital letters. Again, no lowercase forms, just the capital version of the letter, just a little bit bigger or smaller. And we still have that when we change the font size, right? So we still manipulate text and stress it or section it off or something by changing the size. And from that, the last thing I want to talk about is scripts. So certain kind of display scripts, as they're called. So when you want to change, you want to emphasize something or say, well, here's something different happening, we still do that, right? We change the script. We might put italic for something that we want to stress, or we put it in bold, or we use Comic Sans and Garamond or something like that in the same text. And this is what people would do as well. I have read the first developments of this happening, where scribes would use different kinds of scripts to mark off different things in Anglo-Saxon writers or scribes from, I think, the 7th century, 7th or 8th century, where they would have books from Italy, from the continent, and would have a certain kind of reverence towards the writing, towards the texts or the authors, and they would put this, when they would either copy them or quote from them in different texts, they would put this in a special kind of display script. So they would change how the words look to mark it off as from those books when they quote. So people would have a mark when they wanted to signal something as a quotation, which was the dipple. That's, I think I mentioned this before somewhere, that's like a V shape, just horizontal in the margin very often. So then that would mean, well, this is from the Bible, a quotation, for example. This is extraneous material. Or they would just change the type. Today we would maybe say type, the script, as it were. And people have asked me before whether I think italics is punctuation, or capital letters, or lowercase letters is punctuation. And at that time I said, no, I don't think so, because it doesn't really tell me anything about the relation between the words and stuff. But having read on this, I guess one can call it punctuation. I suppose italics, for example, is a graphic convention, or is a phenomenon. I don't want to say accessory, because that sounds as if it wasn't important. It's a phenomenon of writing. It's a graphic convention or something that can function as punctuation too, because it sections something off. It signals something. It does something to the text. It marks maybe a metaphorical boundary then, rather than a physical boundary, which it still also does, right? If you have a Roman and then an italic word and then another Roman word, that marks it off. That creates structure, that creates relationships. So I suppose one can say that script, space, and capitalization is part of punctuation too, or is punctuation as well. And that's my current kind of thinking. Who knows, maybe it will change again, and then nothing is but what is not. But